Yeah, disappointing day. Nothing's really gone to plan. We tried a few things this morning, wasn't feeling so bad, but in the warmer conditions this afternoon, nothing we tried really worked. We've tried many different things, and unfortunately we can't get the front feeling to improve with this new tyre. And so we didn't. I didn't want to push. I kept closing the front. I kept losing the rear, and had no feeling at all with the bike. So we will try again a little bit more tomorrow.
The yellow flag has been shown. The red flag is being taken away. The lights will go to red.
Away they go. Good start from Danny Pedrosa. Whenever he never says that. Here we go. It's Valentino Rossi had a good start.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 325 for Wednesday, the 27th of June, 2012. My name is Jim Race. I am in Northern California, up in the Sierra foothills. With me is Jules Cisek down in the Bay Area, also in Northern California. Good to talk to you again, Jules. That was a great show last week, dude.
Hey, Jim. Yeah. It was amazing. Martin really was a pro. He was a pro.
Yeah, knocked it out of the park. Yep. That's an American euphemism. I wonder what the Brit equivalent is.
I just opened the most saddest beer. You can't even hear. You can even hear it.
That was a beer?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Jesus.
Was that like a Coors Sterling or something?
That was Sierra Nevada, and I missed the pop top.
You whiffed it. Here, this might help you out.
There we go.
A little more solid.
Now the show can properly start.
Yes. We've got some cool stuff for you tonight. A lot of what we're going to do, Jules, is talk about a bunch of listener email, because we have gotten a lot.
Yep.
And it seems like probably the kicker that got everything going and everybody talking about a lot of things was obviously Lorenzo signing, and that's kind of picked up the pace of a lot of things. But also people are starting to get more and more ideas now that we've seen the season settle down about where MotoGP, as an example, is headed.
And the interviews last week were all, there was everyone touched on the CRT thing, you know.
Absolutely.
So there was a lot of food for thought there, and definitely the words flowed.
Yep. Boy, did they. And I have to thank you, sir, because you've been diligently answering these. In fact, you were up until minutes before the show.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to throw in a quip here or there. You know, I see something amusing. I'm like write one sentence out, then I feel guilty. I was like, oh, I have to write four paragraphs too. but really neat. And so thank you guys for writing in. Please continue to do so. We can do so through the Motopodcast page, motopodcast.com, or however else you can find us. We're not hard to find. We also have... and we kind of pushed this out. My apologies to Mr. Miller. But the timing almost couldn't be better, because today the YouTube video of his HBO thing was released from the Isle of Man TT. And you guys in this show are going to get to hear an interview that I did with, I can't call anything I do with Mark anymore an interview.
I was just going to say, it's not an interview.
me and Mark talked the shit for about an hour.
Right.
And to be honest, we talked the shit for about 2 hours. An hour made it on the show. Unless we had a separate audio file segment. If anybody really wants to hear that, feel free to write it and tell me, because I'll be happy to send it to you. But we talked a whole bunch about the TT. This was as we were running up to Silver. I think it was on Sunday. So it was after Silverstone.
Yeah. Oh, was it after the race?
Yeah, I think it was after the race. And so we had a great talk, and, you know, it was a little bit further after the TT than I would have wanted, but I was trying to give him a little space, which is very unsurprising to me, or surprising to me. Excuse me. And so I think you guys will enjoy, obviously you'll enjoy it. And we'll also have a link to the HBO video in the show.
Cool.
Which is pretty cool. And then what else? I almost called you Mark. Jules. Should we just dive into the listener feedback?
Donators?
What do you think? Donators. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. Bad meme. Very, very bad meme. We did get some great donations in the last week or so. I'll run down those names. Chris Annabelle, our patron saint and friend on in New York City, Alex Baverell. Thank you, Alex, very much. Alan Fullerton and William Meyer. Very cool, because it's actually been pretty sparse the prior couple of weeks, and this is certainly a good time to do so, as you and I, Jules, over the last few days have been solidifying.
Haggling. And
what's that? Yeah.
Haggling.
Yeah. Haggling's not a bad word, but we've been solidifying plans for trips for a good portion of the rest of the year. You're jetting off to Europe rather shortly, and then trying to figure out everything and figure out how to keep this ship afloat and charging forward.
Yep.
So very, very cool. We'll talk about how to do donations at the end of the show, but tip of the Motopod hat. Thanks a lot.
Indeed. Thanks, guys.
Yep.
Okay, so let's do this listener feedback, Biz. a couple of these things, it's getting a little bit tricky, actually, to compile all this, because we got Twitter, we got Facebook, we got Google Plus, and we've got email is still, I think, the preferred way if you guys want to have the thing end up on in the show, because sometimes I forget to get all the things off of Facebook, but we're getting better at it. So
I think you're very impressive for actually pulling these things off of Twitter, because 140 characters is not a tome tell.
Well, you know, there's some people say some very interesting things. So, for example, Ron Pritchard, he was replying about the coxisms we had last week, that the great list that that Martin read from. I'm sorry, I forgot the name of the listener that sent that in. But anyway,
an excellent listener wrote it.
Yes, but it was on the Facebook post, and Ron Pritchard tweeted that hands and heels, that particular term that we didn't really know what it meant, is a horse racing term that means no whip, which is not inappropriate. Wow. As used, because I think it had to do with Lorenzo running away.
Yeah, Jules, that is cool. That is very cool.
Yeah.
I should point out to you that occasionally, if we forget a name, I mean, there's so many people that write in. What, we just passed 15,000 people on the Facebook fan page, so it's not personal, folks. It's just
yeah.
There are a lot of you, man. I have trouble remembering the names of people I meet at a new job. So it takes me about 2 weeks. So, but yeah, very, very cool. So, should I travel on?
Yeah.
Ollie Ford, tweeted to remind us that, Batista is riding on Showa as well, Danny and Casey, and Stefan.
I'm not sure about that.
I'm pretty sure Batista is the only one running on shows.
Yeah.
No, actually, Brattle, I don't know. Aaron Orleans, Orleans. And so why Batista is not, it could be the reason why Batista is not suffering from the same chatter problems.
Right. And which is interesting because I mean, if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, because Honda's only been on the show, on the, Olin for one season plus the couple of races we had this year. So yeah. Maybe there's some things they need to work out.
Well, yeah. On top of that, I think, you don't hear the rest of the Hondas complaining about it so much as Danny and Casey, and that being the construction of the new Bridgestone fronts has come in. Yeah. And that may be because they pre-plan to have their bikes tuned to the nth, whereas the satellite bikes might have not necessarily more flexibility, and that's not necessarily a term you want to use when you talk about suspension.
Right.
But to be honest, actually, it is. Flexibility in both the chassis and suspension make a big difference.
To put this a little bit more into context, what this is a reply to is that Bautista specifically was asked by actually it was David Emmett during the post QP conference was asked, are you seeing the same problems that Danny and Casey are seeing with the front tire, the new Bridgestone front tire? He said, no, not at all.
Right.
And, you know, part of it, we were postulating that part of it is just that Bauty's not necessarily pushing the bike as much, and that, you know, he's got a different chassis. But I think that the suspension could also be a part of it.
It could be a factor.
And so that's a good point, Ali.
Yep. Carrying on, Daniel Humphreys said, and this was by email, I believe.
Yes.
Daniel Humphreys says, I had a great time, and at the Day of Champions, I ran into Bradley Smith and asked him for an autograph and the picture. You know, he was so kind to do so until I asked him about next year moving up. I know this is kind of funny. Until I asked him about next year moving up to the Tech 3 team in MotoGP, and he totally dodged my question a number of times, and other people started to ask the same question. And then he just walked off and went into the hospitality, which I thought was very strange. Later that dear Daniel, please use punctuation, which I thought was very strange. Later that night, I stayed for the Day of Champions auction, and Bradley came up to the stage, and still no mention about him going up to MotoGP next year. Then when I came home, I watched the MotoGP race on BBC because I don't have Eurosport or any other channels, and I just have Freeview. Matt Roberts said there was talk about Smith going around that weekend that he wouldn't get his ride, which doesn't surprise me. You know, he's done so much, or he hasn't done much this year on the Tech 3 bike, and that's debatable, maybe. And yeah, I know he's going up against a Kalix and the Suter, but they must have seen something in him to give him that offer, and it seems like maybe they're thinking about it twice now. And clearly, you know, everybody's hedging their bets a bit, and obviously Jules with the performance that Cal's put in this year, and W as well. There's no doubt that if things carry on like they do, that Merve Pontrall is going to want to keep those two blokes in the garage. I mean,
if he can, maybe Cal's got that Ducati thing possibly looming.
Yeah, but you know, if you had a choice. You know,
he's the honey badger. He thinks he's invincible. So who knows? Who knows?
I know. But
the thing is that Hervé is going to do. Given what he said to Martin about this rider lineup, I mean, he had Ben Spies and Colin Edwards, and this is his best rider lineup. So you know he's going to probably want to keep them around. He's going to work hard at that. And the other thing is that I think that a lot of those promises on the contracts were made
2 years ago.
2 years ago, and with hope that things were going to get better economically, sure. That the teams were going to be able to, you know, that a team like Tech 3 was going to actually need a new rider, but mm-hmm. with possibility of Cease drying out and Dovi and Cal having no place to go, possibly. Yeah, it's going to be very hard to. It's just very similar to that to the Johnny Reagan discussion we had.
Yeah,
you know,
something that occurred to me, and I don't think I'd mentioned this to you yet, was because Tech 3 is not, you know, completely rocking the socks off of Moto 2. Would be if Guy Coulon goes into mad scientist mode and Tech 3 comes up with a CRT bike for Bradley.
Yes, and I believe that Pontrall is interested in this in that direction as a possibility.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, Bradley would kind of be like a test pilot.
Well, and it would allow him to get his feet wet.
Yep.
To get used to 1,000.
Yep.
Now, clearly, I think the transition from the Moto 2 bike to or this is at least my mind, the transition from the Moto 2 bike to a Moto G bike, you know what I mean, bike, is probably eased being a four-stroke as opposed to the way that was back in the 250 to MotoGP days.
True.
God, can you imagine having, let's say the 250s were still around and all of a sudden you had to hop on a 1,000cc four-stroke? That'd be quite a change, wouldn't it?
Well, we had that in during the 990 era.
That's true. That's true. And there was absolutely a bit of success. Who did really well coming off of 250s and going on to the 990s?
Well, let me think. It wasn't Lorenzo because he was 800s already.
Yeah. That's a good question.
Wow. I mean, I can't think of anybody actually.
Yeah. Because
dude, that's a good point. I mean, because the guys that did well in the 800s that came out of the 250s, you know, like, I mean, Stoner was there for 1 year and he did okay.
Yeah,
he actually for a rookie season on a satellite team, he did fantastic.
Yeah, he could have done better if in theory, had
not been crashing.
He's been complaining about tires since he got in GP, hasn't he?
Yeah. And then of course Pedrosa, you know, was excellent first year. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's interesting because the 800s required more corner speed, which is the 250 riding style. And look at that, we got Lorenzo, and he won a championship. And yeah,
well, I mean, on top of that, that was kind of what really drove the slipper catch technology to advance very quickly.
Yeah,
was because you had guys coming out of the 250 ranks and two strokes with, you know, basically no engine braking into four strokes with a ton. And that, you know, that is also kind of interesting. That's also what helped push electronics forward, electronically reducing engine braking.
I like it. Very interesting.
But you know, it's all kind of a moot point because we've got four strokes to four strokes now.
yeah. All the way down.
Yeah. Slight diversion there.
This next one is actually from back in April. I've been keeping it on the burner, but I think it's time to talk about it because of the Spieth kind of difficult start that he had this season.
You know, it always gets me scared when I know that you want to go back and talk about old emails. I know I've got one that I still have to catch up on.
Yeah, carry on. Show number 7.
Yes.
Dave McDaniel wrote in saying, my question, more food for thought than an answerable question, is where is the next American MotoGP or World Superbike start going to come from? As far as I can see, the only real prospect right now is Blake Young, who I think is talented enough to get it done on the world stage. If he makes it, though, World Superbikes is probably as high as he will go. Besides Young, there is no one I can see that has a legitimate shot at being the next Ben Spies or Nicky Hayden. And I'm just going to interject here that one of the problems that so Blake is already almost 25 years old. And Ben was 24. He was 24 when he was in Superbikes and won the championship. He's 26 now.
Yeah.
Nicky was 21 when he entered MotoGP, and he won his championship when he was 25.
Yep.
I mean, you know, ages, blah, 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 this way, that way. You know, Josh Hayes is in his late 30s, and he did very well at Valencia, so it's doable. But I think that the problem is, let me continue with the email.
It's a problem of perception, also.
Exactly. Let me actually continue with this email. So it's not a lack of talent. There are plenty of young talented riders: Cameron Bobier, James Rispoli, JD Beach, PJ Jacobson, Benny Solis, Joe. And by the way, that's Joe Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
Red Bull Cup. David says, I think it has more to do with the disintegration of the manufacturer involvement in American road racing. Schwantz, Hayden, Spies, they were all identified by the factories at a young age and brought up through the ranks with full factory support and a professional environment. They had good bikes, good crews, and the freedom to learn the craft without having to chase after sponsorship money, which is a very good point. Due to the near complete pullout of the manufacturers from the AMA, today's young riders don't have the same opportunities. They have to scramble for rides and money, catch as catch can. Hence, you've got the likes of PJ Jacobson subbing for an injured rider in Supersport on a mid-pack bike rather than riding for Kawasaki or Honda in AMA Daytona sport bike. It may well be that Ben Spies will be the last American we will see in MotoGP for quite some time. I hope that is not the case, but without manufacturer support, it's going to be real tough for these young kids to get on that trajectory and make it to MotoGP. So, yeah, and I think that that direction of going from, you know, a national series into MotoGP is extremely difficult and fairly rare. A lot of the reasons why there's so many Spanish and Italian riders is because the feeder series there are smaller. You know, you got the 250s now at Moto2 and CEV, and those guys go into the GPs into the smaller classes. We haven't really seen that much of American riders do that. They go straight to the top because by the time that they're ready, they're at an age where they need to kind of hurry it up, you know?
Yeah, I can just think of a handful of guys that actually spend any time in 250, Americans who spend any time in 250. Let me see, Hopkins did for a bit. And then came back to the States and raced.
You know, we have to go back to like Freddie Spencer days, I think. You know,
yeah.
Back in those days, those guys did do that, Kuczynski. But I think that answer is that we don't know who that rider is because we haven't heard about him yet. I think that there's going to be some rider, American rider, that's not going to be raced through AMA and become a well-known name in America. He's going to be an American who ends up in a European championship that we won't hear about them until they step up, you know?
Yeah, to be honest...
There are Americans racing over there.
What I see happening right now, coming out of the AMA, is probably the next American racer that we see that is probably going to be hot shit over there is going to come out of the Daytona Sport Bike class.
I think you're right.
And go into Moto2 and either make it or break it.
Yep. Or Super Sport on that side.
Yeah, I doubt they would go Super Sport to Moto2. They might go into Moto3, but going from a Super Sport 600 to a Moto3 250 would be, I'm not sure that's something they would.
I'm saying go towards Superbikes. Right, because there's MotoGP and Superbikes, different directions, obviously.
Yeah,
worked for Ben Spies. You know,
I think what we need to do is we need to see guys from here get into the GP paddock or the World Supersport paddock early.
Yes,
and not target the premier classes either in World Superbike or MotoGP, nor have to have the as is you know. Dave points out, have to have the factory backing and involvement to get in there. Because there's no doubt that American Honda, American Yamaha, American Honda solidly backed Nicky Hayden.
Yeah, exactly.
American Yamaha has been solidly backing both Colin Edwards and Ben Spies. And so it would be great to see somebody come out of the DSB ranks because, frankly, that's some kick-ass racing, and it has been for the last 2 or 3 years.
Oh yeah, I know.
Yeah, and it's been getting plenty of notes. There's lots of days where it's right up there on a par, or sometimes even better than Moto2, which is saying something. So,
you know, it may be Elena Miners. She may hop over to Moto2 in a year or two. I mean, she definitely has a talent and the sponsors and all that good stuff. But the other thing is that, you know, Americans tend to like to go big. And
that's true. That
hurts us in the world stage because a lot of the world sports, soccer, Formula One, GP, Superbikes, all these kinds of, you have to start really early.
It's true.
In the right leagues where you are competing against, you know, what are going to be the best riders, players, whatever, on the world stage, instead of just saying, well, you know, let's go straight to MotoGP. I'll just race here in America, and then I'm going to win a couple of championships, and then I'll get a ride in MotoGP. It's just not going to work.
Hollywood. You know, built story, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we like our explosions. We had a little chat on Facebook, you and I, with your buddy.
Oh, yeah.
We like explosions in our movies, and we like, you know, steroids in our athletes.
All right, let's move on.
There's going to be a lot about CRTs, and so I think we should start with this email from Edwin Hauser.
Yep, go.
Who is, by the way, on his feet and completed his first job since the accident.
Well, but which was done on his knees.
Yeah, which is not fun considering the shape he's in. Yeah. So good job, Ed. Keep it up.
Good job, doctors and drugs.
Yeah. But he was writing in about, because we were having a short discussion last week about the lap times. And he said, you know, the reason why, I mean, he think that in the 500cc two-stroke era, it was simply impossible to have the kind of rider consistency because of the engine character of the big two-strokes. If they would have the current technology as far as engine management, it could be a different story. But with what they had available, I think the discrepancy between first and last rider was bound to be vast. That's a very good point. That's a very good point because I think that if you use just the statistics of and look at CRTs and you go, huh, they're not really that far behind. That's one thing. But if you say, yeah, they're not that far behind, but they're always going to be behind, and say, and be pretty damn confident that they're always going to be that far behind, that's very different than saying, well, this rider back in the 90s was getting lapped, but sometimes they finished on the podium.
Yeah.
You know, because everything just came together for them, and the machine had it in them. It just was just so freaking hard to control.
Every clock is right twice a day. Every stop clock is right. Something like that.
Right.
But you know, here's an interesting point too, Jules, is, okay, let's say our ifs and buts did turn into candy and nuts. If you gave everybody on the grid, either now or then, the exact same electronics package, here's the electronics, go race. Well, the guys that were at the front would probably still be at the front. Why? Because it's not just the electronics, it's the guys that make the electronics work. And that is perhaps a bigger part of the equation than the hardware itself.
Yeah, no, totally, yeah. Totally. And, you know, and I would really like to see what would happen. I'm having trouble getting over that nuts comment, by the way.
You never heard the... Okay, sorry.
But anyway, it'd be interesting to see what an alien would do on a CRT.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you ever wonder if people that have no idea what we're talking about listen to our show? Just take that as a non sequitur. I'm going to have a t-shirt that says that. I wonder what an alien would do on a CRT, and I'm going to walk down through a mall. People would look at me like, what? There'd be one guy that goes, I know.
Exactly.
Carry on.
Right. So then we have a bunch of emails about CRTs, and Douglas Edmonston can't shut up. So he wrote it.
Neither can you.
No, man. You know, he and Mike really just fired me up on these two next emails.
Yep.
He writes, Douglas writes, on another note, CRTs and the cost of factory prototype bikes. I'm so glad HRC somewhat announced,
yeah.
They're working on making their own version of a bike that is based on the RC13V that people will be able to buy. Anyway, thankfully, the asparagus, I guess that's, who was the first person that said asparagus, by the way? It was just this last weekend, I think.
No, I heard it well over a year ago.
Oh, okay. I know Redding calls them the Asparagus Brothers. Anyway, thankfully the Asparagus Brothers kept things similar to Portugal. Fastest lap of the race was 2.8 seconds by Lorenzo. Alexis Espargaro's fastest lap was 2:05.690, and Paul Espargaro's fastest lap on the Moto2 bike was 2:07.690, and he adds, rather convenient, I might add. So there's exactly 2 seconds between Paul and Alex. So, like we saw in Portugal, 3 seconds between the fastest factory bike and the fastest CRT, but this time it was an extra second over the Moto2 bike for the CRTs. Even the extra even the extra second over the lap is still quite small due to the length of the lap, which is true. Alex was only 1.56% faster than his brother over a lap. Lorenzo was 3.76% faster per lap. Stupid price gaps for such a relatively small time gap. I'm sure Aston will be quite similar, but not so much at Mugello due to how the home straight is. I suspect Petrucci might not even qualify unless they throw in an engine that will grenade itself on its cooldown lap. And he says, thankfully, the HRC production racer should only be €800,000, and that sounds like a bargain to me. So,
Let me start here.
Yep.
Until a CR team gets handed one of these Honda production bikes, it's complete vaporware to me.
Oh, of course.
When I heard that, read that, I'm like, what are they up to?
Yeah.
That was my first thought.
They're preparing for the future. They're preparing for a future where CRTs are the only entries.
Jules, you know Honda, though.
I'm saying this. The preparation means, I'm not saying they're preparing by building it. They're preparing by saying, hey, you know, you make those rule changes, we'll be ready.
It,
we'll
it
do
just
something.
Seems, Just seemed to me like it was sort of announced with a wink and a nod.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah. We're going to play with the rules as much as we can.
Yeah. You know? It certainly would be neat. Just to point out for everybody, because as soon as this thing came across, I started hearing people go, ooh, I can buy an RC213V factory GP. No, you can't. Sorry.
Right.
No. And
even if you had the money.
Yeah, even if you had the money, you don't have the pedigree. These things are going to be still rare as hen's teeth. And the bottom line is the same thing that was going on back in the day of Lee Spikes is Honda is going to be, you know, have an iron fist on the engines. You can't go inside. You can't do this. You can't do that. Because they're still going to be providing support for it. And so while it is a sale as opposed to a lease like it used to be, which is okay if it happens.
Right. And that's good and bad because you actually – a lease might be better considering how much the technology changes year to year.
Well, no doubt. I mean, you can hand it off to a lower down team.
Right.
The question is you know, are the rules going to change for this? They may have to because all of a sudden Honda is producing – you know, the CRT rules, Jules, as you well know, were not meant to be a manufacturer's bike.
Right. That's what I'm saying. That's why Honda's going like, all right, that's their wink and nudge.
Yeah. Yeah. There was some other point that I was going to make, and I'm sure it'll come to me in the middle of this next CRT email.
Right.
Go for it. All right. And I think this is our last one or second to last one. Who knows?
This is the last one.
This week, we got from Mike Moynihan. I know you guys are all on board with the CRT concept. Just would like to hear a voice during your podcast to CRT counterpoints. You balance other opinions so well on other subjects, and I believe we do, Jules. But feel anything negative on CRT is swept under the rug, so to speak. This is what we have, so make the best of it and give it time to mature. I would like to hear more. Before I carry on, Jules,
yes.
I will say that going back to Moto 2 as an example, you and I were both heading into that in the beginning, and Martin as well, with Dread. And we started to come around just, I think, before the season started. And I'm not going to say, look, we were right, but it did turn out to be a fantastic class. To my surprise. And that series now has, 36 plus 42 races under its belt, 3 years of development. The CRT class has 6 races under its belt.
Yep.
And about, let's give it generously a year and a half of development.
Right.
So the fact that they're not that far ahead of the Moto 2 bikes, especially on the short, tighter, twisty circuits, to me is not surprising. You guys can remember out there that there was a period of time where the Moto 2 bikes were barely ahead of the 125s, and in some cases being eclipsed by the World Supersport bikes. So,
no longer the case.
Yeah, not at all. And so I expect the same exact thing to come out of CRT. So what I'm looking at is a nascent change series to this, and this is why I'm up on it, because I seriously do think that it's going to come forward, and I think speculating on it right now at this early stage of its career, if you will, knowing that it's not going to just disappear, that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know, the other thing is that there's so much negative opinion about CRTs anyway by the fans, that the balance is simply us trying to point out the good things about it. But, you know, I mean, I do have my doubts, because like I said earlier, I think that the point that Ed was making about the 500s kind of woke up in me this idea that, yeah, maybe they're close, but they're always going to be behind by this percentage, you know?
Sure.
And I mean, this year anyway. And, so that is, I love the fact that they get airtime, because I want to see them, But I do understand the frustration with the fans and the other riders about bringing the thing into Parc Fermé and all that kind of stuff. It's weird. It really does feel like the two classes. You know, when if you call it like a two classes racing on the same circuit, and you know, give awards away for the best CRT, then at least call it as such.
Well,
you know?
they almost essentially are. I mean,
they are. Them. They're just not officially calling it two different championships.
I mean, yeah. Well, they essentially are. You watch the official MotoGP.com broadcast. It's done by Gavin and Nick, and they show the standings for MotoGP, and then they show the standings for CRT.
Right.
And
that's true. You mean like the
yeah
at the end, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
you're right.
But the bottom line is I just, to me, and I guess I'm picturing you agreeing with me, is that that's why we're up on them. I mean, I'm happy to point out the downsides, and I think what we're going to see in CRTs is much like we saw in, or we've seen in Moto 2, is that it's kind of a survival of the fittest things, and you're going to see those that aren't able to compete fall down the food chain and eventually wash out. More players come in, bikes evolve, change, teams figure things out. Certainly on the electronics front, that's going to make a big difference. I think a lot of the CRT teams this year, Jules, are playing things a bit conservatively because they don't, well, A, they don't have a whole lot of money, some right. of them.
Mm-hmm.
But B, they're trying to make sure that they've still got engines left at the end of the season. They, if you're a CRT team, and that may be also due to money, and you see where your standings are, and they're limited to 22 engines or 24?
Well,
22.
CRT 12 bikes. Engines.
Oh, it's 12 engines. Okay, sorry. That was a nice doubling for them. They're probably going, yes, that'd be nice. But on the other hand, if they can afford it. You know, taking a penalty, if you're already starting in the back of the grid, big deal, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, if they've got the money to do it.
But I would like to know, for example, how many they've used so far.
We haven't been getting any, but you know, I haven't seen any blow up on the track yet. Have you?
No, but there have been some crashes that may have to, you know, caused enough damage to the engine where it had to be replaced.
But I mean, so really what you're taking then is a financial hit. What else? What is the other penalty? Not much.
Right.
You're already gridded on the back row. Now it would be very interesting. This would be interesting. Okay. Here's another what if. Hypothetical. Let's say you're a team that can't qualify well,
mm-hmm.
But you've got an engine you can tune really well for a race, and you've got money in the team. So you go out, you qualify, you know, second to back row, but you got a fast rider and you've got a fast engine. It just doesn't last that long. Well, start from the back row, maybe finish in eighth, ninth, do the same thing again next week. If you got a good rider. Grenade engines every week because you can afford it. Always start at the back because you got a quick guy.
Yeah. If you have the money, yeah.
Yeah. Now that'll get people talking.
plus no one's going to claim that engine.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Maybe for drag racing.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Should we get back to Mike's? Okay. Where did I leave off?
You left off in the first paragraph.
Oh, actually, I left off right after you said I would like to hear more. Right. Well, Mike, you did. All right. So he's referring back again to last week's show. Kind of. He said, without re-listening to the podcast with Lucio and Hervé's exact comments, I will generalize that MotoGP is the pinnacle, the dream of all motorcycle racing, that it needs to be more than production-based. And I will argue that GRT is not production-based. But I also get economics demand a change, that we can't go with the same old. The money just isn't there. I agree with you. And, you know, I must have missed this. He said, but what about the Gavin Emmett solution? As soon as I read this, Jules, you and I think fell in lockstep, even though we didn't even talk to each other. Gavin thought the best idea was what Kenny Roberts did a few years ago with a Honda V5 stuffed into his own KRR package. that motorcycle manufacturers use a motor from the factories and independent teams wrap it with their own chassis design. To me, that is the perfect solution. All prototype motors, not a modified production engine, with a fresh independent chassis design that was hoped from CRT. The best of both worlds, keeping the class 100% prototype and keeping a clear delineation from World Superbike.
It sounds fantastic.
It does. Sounds great.
Yep.
One of the big things, though, that I mentioned in the last one, Jules, was how Honda kept a stranglehold on those engines.
Yeah.
And they absolutely, to the point sometimes where Honda would actually come, HRC would actually come and get the engines at the end of the race. The engineers on that side of the garage were not allowed to crack the cases. They weren't allowed to go inside. And ultimately we saw what happened with HRC and KR. And then we went to that weird KTM thing, and then we saw, KR out of the garage. Would it be an interesting thing to have happen? Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much the manufacturers, because the amount of support that you have to provide, regardless if you're going to be having our guards around your engines, is probably something that would be pretty expensive. And one of the discussions that I believe you had with him, or I'm not sure, maybe this is something I imagine, was it's not that easy to, I think you did this. You may want to explain it yourself. You were talking about the engine design and actually building a chassis, a custom chassis around it. And that's not necessarily real easy, especially the changes that are made prior to a season.
Yeah, exactly. It was the fact that the upgrades that Honda might make to their motors are not just, they're actually going to change not just the characteristic of the power or anything like that, but it's actually going to change, the mounting points, because the center of gravity is going to change. And, the reason why it's so much easier to do in cars is because there's a lot less, the engine is a lot less part of the motorcycle. It's like, it's a component. It truly is a component. Whereas in motorcycle, it really is part of the chassis, in some cases, quite literally so,
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, imagine, like, because Mike goes on in a different email thread we had about maybe a independent chassis manufacturer might solve Ducati's woes, but they're going to be stuck with the same problem, which is that this engine with a 90-degree V-twin is now, and is part of the chassis. They're not going to be able to just build something drastically different than what Ducati's working on. What Ducati really used to do is fix the delivery characteristics of the engine and not mess with the chassis so much. But anyway, we're going off subject. So the thing is that the other thing is that Team KR spent ridiculous amounts of money when they were in MotoGP, way more than CRTs are spending right now.
Yeah,
way more. I mean, I don't know what the numbers are for CRTs right now, but I know what they were for Team KR, and it's got to be five times more.
Yep.
I mean, we're talking millions and millions of dollars that Team KR was spending. So I mean, I like the idea in theory, and just theory and practice rarely are the same. So unfortunately.
Sure. All right. Well, let me close out Mike's email, mm-hmm. or at least part chapter one.
Right.
And so he goes on. Here is my personal twist. Instead of the factories providing two factory bikes and two satellite bikes for a total of 12 on the grid, each factory provides two factory bikes and four standalone engines for independent team use. Surely that would be easier and cheaper for the factories to build four motors for satellite teams instead of two full bikes. Then each factory would be contributing to six bikes on the grid, two from their full factory effort and four engines to be put into the Suitors, Aspars, Paulbirds of this world. That would create 18 bikes, and if Suzuki and Kawasaki and or Aprilia could rejoin, potentially 24 bikes.
Again, it's a good theory, but mm-hmm. I think that there's a misconception here that the engines are the most expensive part of the motorcycle.
Yeah.
And I think that I would not be surprised if I found out that the chassis design, the electronics, which I guess you could consider part of the engine. You know, all the testing, all the stuff that they have to do with the Bridgestone tires ends up costing just as much as developing the motor.
Well, I think, Jules, the bottom line is as technology is advanced in MotoGP, and frankly, it's you know, it's like trying to do a CRT concept in World Superbike, even though that's a production-based series. An engine is just part of the quote-unquote package.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons why CRT is not doing that great right now is because they don't have their whole package together yet. And there's no doubt that some of those bikes are putting out incredible amounts of horsepower. And some of them have engines that are probably putting out well into the 220 range, you know, 210, 220, which is what the GP bikes of just a few years ago were getting.
Yep.
So they got plenty of power, but they don't have the package. That means electronics, that means chassis. So if Honda gives them a 240, 250 horsepower engine, which doubtful that they would do, they could, because they know that team isn't going to have the package to challenge the factory boys.
Well, but the danger would be there. See, the thing is that
imagine
if Honda was forced to follow these kind of rules where the same motor that they put into their factory bike.
You're on crack that it never happened.
Yeah, exactly. It would never happen because they'd be like, well, are you crazy? Goodbye.
Well, I mean, you know? they would have a very valid reason for saying so.
Of course.
Which would be...
they could get beaten.
No, they would have an absolutely technically valid reason for saying so, is that we understand as the factory team how to maintain our motor allocation over the space of a season. If we hand this to another team, they may not be able to do so, yet we would end up being liable for it. So we're going to hand them a detuned engine, and that's that.
Mm. Yep.
I don't think anybody could argue with that. Nope. Any of the factories could say that. And it's true. It's true.
So, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think I'm mini ranted. All right.
I'm pretty sure we're going to be talking about CRTs for the rest of the season, and especially as we, you know, watch that whole series unfold. Mm-hmm. And like you said, I think the most salient point from all this is let's remember the Moto2 class. Now, obviously, the entire class changed, so that was a little bit different. Yep. Whereas we have this weird hodgepodge of prototypes and CRTs right now, but
dichotomy.
Yeah, but let's. I think the best advice is what Jim said earlier. Is just let's wait. Let's see what happens.
Yep. I'll take you guys back to last year. I think it was last year. In BSB, the Superbikes.
Oh yeah, the Evo class.
Yeah, racing with the Evo class, yeah. And that in the beginning of the year wasn't so exciting. Near the end of the year, we had an Evo bike win one of the races.
Yeah,
that is what I was basing my prediction on at the beginning of this year, and it wasn't even. I don't think it was in the wet.
No, it wasn't.
It was one of the last three or four races. Laverty's teammate, I think. What was his name again? Hillier.
Oh, Hillier. Yeah, was it?
Yeah, I think it's Donington.
Wow.
That's it. But all you Brits are going to go, no, you're wrong, you yank bastard. all right. Should we launch into Mark for a bit, or you want to do the pre-show? Good Lord, did we not only just do a whole bunch of pre-show bits, Jules?
Yeah, I know. Let's do news. Let's do the weather report, and then let's shoot into...
All right, we'll keep up with the GP stuff. You saw my comment in here?
Yes.
on the sideline? Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Jules, I'm not sure if I believe this, so I'm going to let you read it instead.
Okay. So, there was an article published on, MCN, Motorcycle News, and it's about, the shaping up of the calendar for 2013, which right now is could begin with four flyaway rounds that would include India, Qatar, Texas, and Argentina. And the interesting thing that came out of this is that that apparently Espeleta has said that there will not be three rounds.
Allegedly.
Allegedly said that there will not be three rounds in 2013, three American rounds, which would mean that, you know, which would be very strange because we've got this Texas round coming up, Austin, and we've got Indy with a contract that's just signed last year. That's, I think, good until 2014. Mm-hmm. And a contract with Laguna Seca that's good until 2014 or 2016, actually.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously, again, it's an alleged thing, as Espeleta has said, but you know, I kind of can see, as much as I would hate to see it, I can kind of see Laguna going away unless they can bring the support classes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it kind of starts to make sense that that whole issue with, well, it's just MotoGP going this one round. It's kind of strange. And
you never got to see the 250s at Laguna, did you?
No, man. No, I never did. I moved out here long after that happened. I moved out here in 95. Well, actually, not long after, I just missed it.
Spring chicken. I'm still okay. So much unlike some potentially promised rider contracts, the contracts that these guys sign are pretty much very defendable in a court of law. And I think the FIM / Dorna knows not to fuck around with them, that they sign with the circuits, which would lead me to believe, knowing that there are contracts between both Indianapolis and Laguna, that the person left out perhaps for 2013 would be Texas. And
yeah. And the thing is that I actually have not heard that from anyone except the Circuit of Americas, which is the Austin circuit, that the deal is go.
I haven't even heard it from them either.
No, they have said it. They have said they had a press release of some sort where they said that all the issues have been resolved.
Okay, I read that, but at the same time we also heard that no, they weren't from. there's nothing been, as far as I understand, there's nothing been signed yet. Perhaps the requirements have been resolved, but right. there's not a signed contract yet. Yeah, until the FIM does a track inspection. Nothing is done.
Well, yeah. But the thing is, there's no doubt that the Circuit of Americas is gonna pass. I'm not doubting that. You know, we're gonna have F1 over there, very soon, and I'm sure it's gonna be heralded as a great facility. But like you said, I think that's a very, very good point. Is that these contracts are not easily broken.
I actually did see some pictures from it the other day, and they had a picture of the front straight, the front straight leading back to the last turn, I think it was. And I looked at that, I'm like, oh, okay, that's pretty cool. They still got a lot of work to do, no doubt. But yeah. I like the
layout. Looks interesting.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the layout looks really cool. I think the one thing that everybody's worried about that's going to be attending F1 there is. The conversation of it really sounded like Laguna to me. It's like there's one road. It's like a two lane road going in and out. How are we going to get in? Harkening back to 2005 and trying to get in and out of that place. Remember that, Jules?
Oh my God, yeah. They fixed that very quickly, though.
They did. They opened up the mine strewn roads that are going out through what was then Fort Ord.
About to experience Mugello, which is going to be.
Yes, you are.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Because I hear that the in and out there is insane.
Well, I believe that's when you just stay there. And you probably will. I mean, what's the point of leaving? You know? Really? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Well, on top of that, you're going to be there with a couple of other experienced journalists that know the ins and outs anyway, so to speak. Well, actually, the ins and outs is quite appropriate in that conversation.
Hello, Andrew. So, a little bit more on this. I think that... There was a discussion on Facebook that this generated, which was, you know, why the hell do we have so many Spanish rounds and America deserves more rounds, blah blah blah. Yes, it's true, but if you do want to do a cost analysis, you know, it's very easy to run races in Europe. extra races in Europe. Dorna's doing, and the FIM are doing a great job expanding. You know, it's a world championship, so we want to see it all over the world. So it's great that we're going to go to Argentina. I'm so psyched about that. And
you didn't mention India.
What's that?
You didn't mention India, too.
Well, India for superbikes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in the end, it's if they have to, you know, have an 18 calendar, 18 races in the calendar year, and I think that that's their, most of the riders have said no more than 18, you know.
Like, many of them have said, we have a few fewer, please.
Yeah, they want to, I think they want to go back to 16, a lot of the riders, but fine, whatever. 18, is, let's say that's the limit, so they're going to have to readjust everything, figure out who, you know, what the contracts look like, and, you know, if Spain keeps coming up with it, it's not just favoritism, but there's, I'm sure, a little bit of that, but...
I mean, part of it is the per fan capita. I mean, if you can get...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, Assen is having some troubles filling seats, you know, apparently, but that doesn't happen in Spain.
Yeah, the upcoming Rana Misano is actually, their ticket prices there for like 12 euros again. Yeah. No, again, for this GP round coming up.
Oh, the one coming up? Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So they're going to do the same thing that Estoril did?
Kind of, yeah.
Wow, because I thought it was brilliant at Estoril. It's like, you know, if you're going to be able to...
Pack the stands,
let's just do it. Let's just do it, you know?
And frankly, them doing that was probably the wisest thing they ever did because, you know, depending upon if there is a chance of it reoccurring, because they had a lot of people that hadn't been to a race before.
Right.
And they had a great experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and the other thing is that, I mean, you can't complain about the Spanish rounds because they're all freaking great.
Yeah.
You know, we've had some fantastic racing there, so.
You can complain about Valencia sometimes.
I guess. Yeah, that's true. That's true. But that's really like a party.
True. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, the party you have at the end of the year when you graduate high school.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right. So
we do have racing coming up.
We do. And frankly, by the time this show hits your guys' ears, we'll probably have a little bit of racing, or not racing, but a little bit of qualifier practice, at least, in the books. As you guys well know, Assen MotoGP is a Saturday race, and traditionally has been throughout the entire GP beginning to GPN career span. Therefore, they will be practicing starting Thursday morning, which for you and me, Jules, it nearly is.
Right.
We're approaching rapidly. So I did take a peek at the weather beforehand, did a little cut and paste here. Right now, as we speak, it's about 7 o'clock in the morning there, 7:30. Today's going to be high. It's going to be 77 Fahrenheit on Tuesday or tomorrow night. Supposed to drop down to 61 and some
about 25 degrees.
Yeah, some weather comes in. 80% chance of rain tomorrow night, 20% chance on Friday, and then but the weather is still, you know, fairly warm, Jules. Doesn't get real cold, and then 50% chance of rain on race day. So that should be kind of interesting. What was the weather like last year, Jules? I can't remember.
I think
it was relatively sunny and cool.
I know it was dry because Simoncelli crashed in the beginning and Spies ran away.
Yep.
I'm trying to remember. I think you're right. I think it was fairly coolish.
Yep. I think it was just a bit overcast. And you know what? I was looking at this weather. I was like, that's not bad, really. Because they've had worse conditions. And what isn't noted on here was that it looks like the wind is going to be too bad. So it's going to be no Donington.
It was 16 degrees. It was 16 degrees Celsius, so 60 Fahrenheit.
I said Donington, but I meant Silverstone. Martin didn't talk about it so much last week, but I would have kind of liked to hear a long, rambling take, hardcore take on the weather.
I'm talking about Assen last year. Sorry, Assen last year was 16 degrees Celsius, so it was fairly chilly.
Okay.
But cooler.
So that should be fun. And I'm looking forward to this weekend. It's considering that, and this is just a fanboy thing for me. I'm looking forward to seeing what Ben Spies can do because I think he's coming back up. We shall see.
Yeah.
What else?
Superbikes are also racing this year. this weekend.
They are. Yeah, this is a double A weekend, isn't it?
Yep.
We got both Assen and Aragon. Aragon, on the other hand, is, you know, Jules, I was trying to do some fact checking before I got on the phone with you, but I think these temperatures are real. and when I say real, I mean real hot.
Yeah. Dude, it gets hot there.
Yeah, just before you and I got on the phone, I was trying to get a hold of Sylvain because he was online just to see if he could verify that. But on Friday, 101 degrees Fahrenheit. Ouch. Very hot with sunshine, it says, with a big old red thermometer. Not much better on Saturday, 98. But here's where it's going to get interesting, Jules. So Friday and Saturday, which are
practice qualifying.
Practice and qualifying, Super Pole. Going on to Sunday, temperature is dropping way down. We're going down 16 degrees, maybe more, and it sounds like there's going to be a little bit of wind. And that's going to fuck with their, you know, everybody, you know, if it actually happens, people are going to be prepared. But who knows what's going to have happen go into Sunday. It could be weird.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that all of your practice and qualifying occurs on a setup that you know is going to be different. Now, if you know it's going to rain, you can kind of prepare for that, use old data, but there's not a whole lot of old data for World Superbike at Aragon.
No, nope.
So.
Yeah, I mean, that place is like a desert. So it, yeah. It could be cold. I mean, when I was there, it was cool and overcast, and it was threatening rain.
Yeah. Like, oh man, I can just see the heat shimmers coming off of that big wall.
Oh yeah.
Is that wall climbable? Like if you were a climber?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you don't even have to have equipment to climb it. There's a slight
angle to it.
Yeah.
I want to go to that wall. That's my weeping wall.
The cool thing about it is you can stand on top of it, and there's no, I mean, it's cool. It's scary because there's no railing or anything like that. And I was standing there, you know, when you're looking through the lens and you start to lean forward and you're like, whoa, yeah. I'm about to end up on the track.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Let's get on with Mark.
There's not even been any racing.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It'll probably be me and Martin next week. He's going to talk my ear off, isn't he? All right, so Mr. Mark Miller, a friend of mine extraordinaire and ladies man, currently at the Isle of, still at the Isle of Man, hanging out with Miss Vero, who does appear, so to speak, briefly in this, along with plenty of Mark's imaginary friends. we had a long talk. I know you guys enjoy hearing him on the show, and Mark, thanks for coming on again. I'm looking forward to him getting back in the States, at least for a brief visit. And maybe I'll go down there and hang out and do another show like we did a couple of years or a year and a half ago or something like that when I was down in LA. But we talked about everything. Racing, a lot of racing stuff. You guys will hear some electric stuff as well regarding the TT0. And as you well know, who knows where we go. So let's go ahead and roll that. And we'll come back and see if we can't close this train wreck out. Jim Race here for Motopod, and after some delay and a bit of chit-chat before the call about everything audio, I've got Mark Miller on the line, happily ensconced in bed with Vero at the Isle of Man. How you doing, Mark?
Hello, Jim.
Hello, Vero.
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Of course, I'm doing well. Yeah, when we talked for half an hour beforehand about everything under the sun, then it's kind of like, oh, we got to do a call, too. You, sir, are probably just about recovering from Saturday night at Colors at this point, post-TT. You didn't get your senior. We'll talk about that in a bit. But the TT experience overall, you were out there with a bunch of people that I know. You had your man Dave Hopkinson at the helm for you, working on the bike with the Redmond Split-Lath Aprilia team. Just give me a rundown. Start at the beginning and work your way through, and I'll interject when I get a chance. Thank you.
You're welcome. Overall,
I'm going to leave that in.
She's laughing her ass off. I'm sorry, baby. I know she wants to be proud of her boyfriend. You know, she wants me to be like a gentleman, and she's such a nice girl.
Only with me.
It was a positive experience. I mean, it was cool. It's nice to see the family. You know, the big TT family comes to town, and I only see him a couple times a year, either Macau or there. And Hopkinson's such a cool dude, and you know, everyone's kind of got some energy about it. Of course, it started really weird with my would-be teammate Mark Buckley. We spoke about this briefly. Was killed the week before, and that sucked. You know, that's like a big deal because his crashed motorcycle was up in the truck, up in the semi truck in the second layer. And you just like, dude, I got this whole huge awning and stuff for me. And it's like, it was the energy of Mark Buckley has gone from the paddock. It's kind of like, it's weird. It's like, if you have, I mean, I've had a pet, you know, a beloved pet die in the house, and you come home from the veterinarian basically, and it's like, there's that energy's gone out of the house. It's really tangible. Mark was gone. You know, he wasn't around, and you could feel it. It was really weird.
And there's an interesting sort of story, backstory behind that, or forestory, if you will, in that Dave Hopkinson, did he put that bike back together, or was it a second bike? Because Dave got nicked by the
no.
That's a great story. I think you should tell that one. I can tell what I know of it, but
The short story was, Dave Hopkinson, my chief mechanic for this year's TT, was good friends with Mark Buckley and had been communicating with him about some of the bike stuff prior. Mark was on one of the split lath bikes when he fell off at the Northwest. He had done some testing. They had talked back and forth between Dave and Mark, and so they were mates, you know. And Dave Hopkinson also knew his wife well, and his father, Jim, who everybody knows in the paddock, is Mark Buckley's father. Is a super cool guy. They're all from Scotland, I think. And are they Scotland or Irish?
Scotland.
So when it came time for all of us to get together at the TT without Mark, there was an extra superbike there for him, ready to go, kind of a thing. And he was, you know, had his special numbers and all that stuff. Everything, the stickers were made in advance. Obviously, you show up and you have certain starting numbers, and the bikes are really well organized. So there's specific custom made wrap stickers that wrap around this windscreen and the shape of that particular motorcycle fairing. And they're all done with this, a couple sponsored logos. Well, Mark's, custom logos were made for his superbike and stuff. So what Homeboy wanted to do was go organize a memorial lap for Buckley, and the wife came, and she was in Jane was in a support car, actually one of the TT course cars with yellow flashing lights on the top of the fucking thing. Had 100 motorcycles show up in the pouring rain to do this memorial lap around the TT course on a Monday with all the traffic and stuff. Nobody was going over 30 miles an hour, and Mark Buckley's would-be race bike, TT bike, was being ridden by Dave Hopkinson, who's also a TT, also a club racer and a track day guy, a good rider. And so he was full leathers and helmet stuff with Mark Buckley's superbike with Mark Buckley's numbers on it, you know, custom Buckley stickers on the windscreen and the whole nine yards. It was a Mark Buckley bike. So Dave wanted to take the race bike around the course during the memorial lap, following a course car, and then being followed by about 100 motorcyclists, and so that Mark Buckley's race bike could get around the lap. You know, it's just to sort of say the bike did a lap in honor for Mark.
Sure. Yep.
Well, we get to the gooseneck, start in the mountain, just, you know, a couple miles to go after the whole lap at 30 miles an hour with streetlights and stuff like that.
You were riding a scooter, weren't you?
I was riding a little Aprilia scooter because I didn't want to be on anything powerful. I would have started screwing around and I would have crashed it in the rain and dickhead. So I just wanted to just go and be part of it. But, you know, so I was on the little scooter, and there's times when they'd all pass me because I couldn't go uphill any faster. It was really slow. And I'd catch back up and skid to a stop and do screw around and, you know, shut off people's ignitions and stuff like that. I mean, that's what, you know, Mark would have loved that. That's the whole idea is we're there for Mark Buckley. So we get up to the gooseneck, start the mountain. And this fucking cop is in front of us. And we're like, oh, yeah, big deal, you know, no big deal. He fucking turns on his lights and stops the whole street, the whole road, one-way traffic over the mountain, and gets out of his car and comes back and says, you don't have any registration on this motorcycle, and there's not a light. There's no lights on this thing, and there's no tail thing. You got insurance for this? It's a memorial lap. You know, our friend got killed last week at the Northwest, and his wife's in the car here with his uncle, and there's a course car. I mean, there's 100 of us, and, you know, we're just going really slow over the mountain as a parade lap, you know. Oh, you're going to have to pull it over to the side here, and we're going to have to get your information out. You're going to have to get a van to come and pick this bike up off the street. You're joking. Like, you just dickheads, you know? Like, what are you doing? Your ego, you know, it's just so dumb. All we had to do is just tool over the thing. Long story short, too late. About an hour later, we're back in the paddock. I stayed with Mark. Everyone else went on. So we put the scooter and the superbike in the back of the split lath little minivan and got back to the racetrack. And the, you know, Manx TT radio got word of it and stuff. It came over and we actually got interviewed about it. And then, so of course, it was only an hour after we were, you know, taken off of the road. So the whole island was buzzing about this.
It went internationally viral. I heard people talking about it everywhere.
Well, the guy's partner, who's an older dude with some gray hair and stuff, looked like a cool bloke, was rolling his eyes behind this other street cop, like going, I don't know why he's doing this. This is embarrassing. It's behind a TT
right
car. It's a course car. You know, it's like a little bit kind of legitimate gig. And it's a racetrack anyway, and it's a one-way traffic with no speeding limit. There's no speed limit over the mountain. It's just sort of a liberal place anyway, typically. So, you know, the other cop was saying that. And then the prosecutor, when Dave went into court, was saying, that guy's a problem. Nobody likes him. You know,
He had to go into court Saturday morning.
Yeah, before the races and stuff. He had to go to court a couple times. Then the judge says, you shouldn't be here. You know, just get out of here. What are you doing? We're embarrassed by this whole thing. And, you know, we're trying to like get along with the community as it is. And then this guy has to do this hugely, you know, amplified. What is it called? You know, where it's the word is out. So, I mean, there was going to be like a fund to raise money for the fines. And, you know, it could have been like a big deal. If the guy wanted to be weird, he could have said, well, there's no insurance on the bike and there's no plates on the bike, whatever it is. I mean, you can run race bikes around the island to test them as long with numbers plates, no lights or nothing, as long as you get some insurance for it. Like, there's lots of little wiggle room, you know. It's like, it's not like a public road where everybody's, you know, it's not the middle of LA, you know. This is a fucking racetrack around an island and we're behind a course car. So it just, anyway, they said it was not a big deal. We're so sorry. It was an embarrassment and go home. You know,
they still popped him with whatever they call Manx points. What are those?
Well, they have a minimum by law. The judge had to give him like two or something Manx points, which is like points against your driver's license. But it absolutely does not matter in the UK.
Okay.
So it doesn't make his insurance go up. It doesn't mean that you can't rent a car or it didn't cost him one dime. It just basically is a procedural thing that says we have taken note that, you know, you've been pulled over. But it doesn't mean anything. So thank God, you know, because everybody was kind of a little bit like up in arms saying, well, if anything happens here, this is going to be ugly because it's anyway, that's the story.
it was a bit dramatic in the end. But I was glad that he essentially got off, so to speak. That was kind of a dimming moment for the TT. And I know he was a little bit worried about the whole thing, too.
Yeah, he couldn't help but be a little worried about it. Because can you imagine if you got like a $360-pound fine or an 800-pound fine or whatever weird – who knows? Because you never know with traffic cops. And you know, in L.A., it's ridiculous how stupid and how expensive stuff can be. So you just never know. The funniest thing about it was Mark Buckley was sitting up there laughing his fucking ass off. He says, well, that's a nice send-off. Thank you, guys. You know, that's one for the record books. You know, it wasn't just a simple little memorial lap. It turned into this sort of international, you know incident. So, you know, good. Why not? You know, only a famous death will do. It's good stuff.
Yeah. it was fun to watch from afar. All right. So let's talk about the team and the bike. You know, let's go back a little bit further. Practice week. How did that go for you? Because I know that, and one thing I do want to talk about is because you ended up later on during race week swapping out the suspension. But tell me about practice week.
We struggled. You know, it's a stiff chassis, Max Biaggi reverse engineering from MotoGP. It's got a V4, which is a heavy chassis, and has a short swing arm, and it likes to wheelie. And because the traction control turns off over the big, massive jumps, we have to shut it off completely. So we had no wheelie control. So basically, I've got all mid-range torque with these beautiful V4 engines that have 110 pounds of torque. And I don't know if you know what other bikes have, but that's apparently high.
Yep. That is high.
It's right coming off mid-corner. The thing just wheelie. And then over the fast bits, the suspension was not working. And we're on these stiffer in-tech English-made Dunlops, and the bike is designed for these squishy, soft, spongy Pirellis.
Right.
And I don't like the Pirellis, and I always crash on the fronts. If you remember during the World Endurance stuff, I just couldn't hardly get on with the Pirellis. Eventually, they had a new rear that helped. But
that's an interesting point, because the Bridgestones with the ART bikes that are running in the CRT class over in MotoGP are super soft, squishy tires, much like the Entex. And I wonder if that is holding those guys back. Sorry, I'm diverging here, but that just comes to mind.
I mean, chassis, I think, are, you know, like the front Hondas are struggling with the newer construction front MotoGP tires, but yet the Yamaha, which is absolutely on rails today with Lorenzo just toying with poor Stoner there in the corners. He's like, look, I'll just stay on the outside of you and just, you know, I can do whatever I want with this Yamaha. It was actually really brilliant to watch, whereas the Honda was bucking and weaving and it was, you know, doing all these weird things. And I think some of that had to do with that new front tire. But tires are everything. And we could talk a little bit about that later as well. But as far as the suspension goes, the Maxxin suspension, which was something that Mark Buckley liked to work with on other bikes of his in the past. I don't know if it's for cost is cheaper, they're English made, or if there's some kind of relationship there. But, you know, he had basically talked the team into saying, well, I know the Maxxins, can we try those? And they went and bought a bunch of Maxxin stuff. I always used the K-Tech and Olin stuff because those guys are at the racetrack. I've dealt with those guys with Ken and K-Tech for years at the TT. Trust them. They always take care of me. They always do everything and beyond whatever I ask. The Maxxin guy we had tried once before at some year on some bike somewhere, and the same kid that's in charge of it, one guy, he didn't have time for us then, and he didn't have time for us this year. Mm. So, frankly, I just, you know, after 4 days of beating our head against the wall trying to get these things to work, I said, look, can we just put the K-Tech on there, please?
Did you have them still?
Well, they had – what's funny is the bike we had set up last year, the K-Tech stuff went onto the boss's track day bike. And he wouldn't give it to us. He says, this is my bike, and I haven't touched a single click. I haven't touched one single thing since last year, since you guys set the suspension up, and I really like it the way it is. Please, let's take a mirrored set, another set off another bike, because these guys have a lot of motorcycles. We'll take another set over to K-Tech and have them absolutely duplicate it exactly to what you guys had last year. So we had a second one made, and it worked instantly.
Yeah, so that's what you said.
But it was already fucking Friday. I mean, it was already like the week was over. So the whole goal of the team this year, and it was rightfully so because of Mark Buckley thing, and also because last year was a bit of a fiasco with the gas tanks being welded weird. It's like Frankenstein and all this stuff. Is that we just wanted to finish three races. That was the main goal. Finish, nothing silly. Don't run out of gas. Don't look ridiculous. Let's get some confidence and get this thing working. So the first race, I think, was it on the Maxxin or was it on the K-Tech?
I think you ran the first one on the Maxxin.
Okay, so we ended up, you know, 30th or something out of 70. And that was about that's riding the thing as hard as I possibly could. And it wasn't from a lack of, like, you know, top speed or anything. It was basically I couldn't get over the bumps and I couldn't keep the front wheel down. So then we went to the Maxxin, or we went to the K-Tech after that. And that was, for Superstock or something. And we finished it the same. We did go faster, but we were really looking forward to the senior, actually, because we had gotten the thing working. We knew we had endurance on the gas tank. We hadn't popped any of the speed limiters on the pit stops, which we did last year, because there was no – on the stalker bike, there was no limiter. Like I could do gank. They didn't have that. So
real quick, didn't you run in the superbike class? Didn't you decide in the end to run the super stock bike for all three classes?
Yes, because the superbike was absolutely unrideable. It had more horsepower, more torque. It had the stiffer swing arm, the stiffer triple clamps, the lighter wheels, 16.5 tires, which are also hard to dial in. At that racetrack, a lot of the Dunlop riders now, like Swan Yamaha, uses 17-inch superbike wheels. McGinnis was on 17.
Is that just for stability?
They seem – well, the development, first of all, with the 17s, because of the USA, the AMA series and stuff, they're using 17s. I think maybe Japan's using 17s. 16.5 Dunlops are basically gone.
So there's no further development. I know Clive Pagent was running 17 as well. So everybody got off the 16.5s about 2 years ago. And so we didn't have 17-inch superbike wheels. So the bike was just stupid. I mean, it was unrideable. And we didn't have enough time because the Stalker, we had started the week, the practice week on the Stalker. We didn't even get on the superbike till like the night before the superbike race. Mm. And it was so far off, we didn't have any more time to develop it. So we just said, look, we've got the Stalker at least rideable now. It's not, you know, dangerously tank slapping anymore. Let's just run that. So we did. And we did the two races. We finished both races. You know, we could have gone faster. I should say it would have been nice to have gone a little bit faster. But, you know, we were basically trying to be overly cautious and finish the races. And the senior was really our time to really put our head down now because we knew we had a motorcycle that worked. We knew about the tires. We knew what they're going to do. We knew about how much grip we had. We knew about the wheelies. We knew about – you know, we had the wheelbase right. We had the gearing right. We actually could have used a little bit different gearing, but we could not source out the right size rear sprocket. It just didn't exist in the UK at the time. So, it's a pretty unique motorcycle, the Aprilia RSV4. So you can't just go down to Ernie Coates and say, Dave, you got a 4.1. You know, they don't got them. And then nothing else seems to work. Like, we looked for, you know, other different brands of wheels, and nobody seemed to have the 17-inch stock wheel hub and center diameter and all that crap and the bolt pattern and...
That is some pretty rare kit. Super Stock went pretty well. But in between that and waiting for the senior on Saturday, we had a sort of a combination of rain and other stuff. But in the meantime, you still ended up running a electric bike race.
We did. We had one practice. We were scheduled to do two practices and then the race. We ended up getting one practice and it rained, but in the first practice, since they had built a second – Motosys had built a second bike that's a duplicate of Rudder's from last year. So Rudder was on the base – effectively the same bike he raced last year. They built a second one, mirrored second one for me. The manufacturer of the carbon fiber chassis that – the chassis was sent to is the one that bakes it. You know, it's the one that actually physically manufactured it. The guy didn't put the neck, the aluminum sleeve that goes into the neck. It wasn't faceted like it should be because it's not pressed in because it's carbon and aluminum. It actually used like some aerospace quality epoxy with certain grooves that it, you know, it's all worked out so that this epoxy will hold that neck into place. And then the bearings go top and bottom for the fork tube and all that stuff. It wasn't epoxied, and when it came back, yeah, and it wasn't anybody in the team's fault at all. It was just something. It was just a brand new bike, you know. It had never been run before, and it's one of these little things out of a million little things of building your own race bike that's capable of going around that Isle of Man TT track. The thing wasn't epoxied, so the very first practice, which turned out to be our only practice, the front neck was moving a few mil inside the front of the bike. So, you know, I come off the thing and, hey, what'd you think? Is the handle a lot better, you know, a lot better than last year's bike? Because that's what Rudder had said. Excuse me. And I said, actually, no, something's wrong. It's just, it's hopping up and down everywhere. And I had to go really slow through the bumpy stuff. Something wasn't working right. So they couldn't figure out what it was for a couple hours. And then they found it. And everybody was super jazzed because they found a specific problem, which is a physical problem. And they fixed it. So we were supposed to have that second practice and it got rained out.
Now, I think it's pretty much public knowledge that your dash also took a dive during that first practice, right?
Yeah, both bikes had these custom, you know, gauges which are very, very important for the electric bike race. It's part of the strategy. They froze. And so what they ended up doing, which is no drama, they just went back to the system from before, which is it's simpler system. It's not quite as, you know, it takes a little bit more of the rider.
It's not as user friendly.
Yeah, I mean the new one was super cool. Like the newest setup was very, very intuitive. It was very easy to read, and it was brighter and more exacting, and more precise. Blah blah blah. But. It was not a big deal. I mean, that was a non-issue when they went back to the old one worked fine and it didn't have a glitch. What's interesting about this, and I'm learning more about the electric stuff, is it's really fascinating how many different systems are on the bike and how many different companies that like have a little say in it. For instance, like the carbon fiber chassis guy and the inverter, which comes from, you know, some other West Coast entity where, you know, MotoSys is designing this millimeter by millimeter and has to sub out some of the technical stuff, you know, like the carbon fiber baker, the right. guy that does, you know, they don't do that. They would give it down the street to this guy to the exact standards or whatever. We had this glitch in the gauges and it's like, well, we have to wait 8 hours for the West Coast to wake up and we can send them the error mm-hmm. codes that the inverter is sending to our laptop and then see if they can't, like, you know, their code writers can look into there and see if there's something they can remedy. You know, they're just, it's awesome. You know, it's just so cool. It's a race bike, you know?
Yep.
But it's really neat. So they figured out the gauges. And we did the one race. Now, McGinnis, this is a little bit of a story. I've got to get give my hats off to, not only the MotoSys guys for, you know, building such an incredible bike to go 104 mile an hour average, you know, through damp patches and stuff and beating obviously a very decent, try by basically factory Honda with hiding behind the Mugen name. I mean, they had full blown Honda factory representatives there and engineers there. Oh, yeah. And it was neat. I mean, it was cool. It was a big effort. They brought two bikes.
I heard that.
For just McGinnis. And their strategy, it turned out, and I had heard this earlier in the week, the strategy was to actually get him out, do his 20-minute lap, then put him on the second bike, which is freshly charged, and do a second lap. So McGinnis, as a rider, would get twice as many laps of practice than everybody else, and they would be able to gather the data with the two motorcycles. So we went over there, and actually, I when I heard that, I went and talked to the TT people. I just to ask them. I said, "Is that now? Is this a one lap? Since the race is one lap, qualifying is one lap. Everything's about, you know, your endurance after one charge of battery. Is the rules saying is it a, you know, a 30-minute session, or is it one lap per rider? Right. Like they'll say the sidecars, this is a one lap practice this tonight. It's yeah. not, you know." If you can get around within enough time to do a second lap, if you can just make the checkered flag or just before the checkered flag, you can go for a second lap. If they specifically say one lap. And I asked him if it was one lap or not one lap. And he says, no, actually, I never thought of that, guys. No one's ever had two bikes for one rider before. The rules say it's a 30-minute session. So McGinnis has, you know, within the letter of the law, can go out and come back in, jump on a second $500,000 electric bike and get a second lap before they checkered flag it. And yet, you know, he'll be the only one on the racetrack at that point because everyone else has already left and done their one lap. So, and I said, okay, well, is that what you guys want to do? Is it one lap or is it 30 minutes? He says, well, for this year, we have to stick to the schedule. Well, the Mugen guys were called in to ask him about that. And the Mugen guys took it upon themselves to say, we don't want to show up and be unfair and have our rider get twice as much practice, even though that's what we were thinking of doing. Now that you've brought it up, we have decided to not do that out of the fairness of everybody else with the Kingston University guys, the Indians, the American guys coming over, all the little universities, the dudes in the shed and Ramsey, nobody can bring the resources like Honda from Japan can, you know, who make aerospace fucking yeah. satellites and robots. And obviously they've got all the technology in the world. They've been racing around with electric bikes for years with Japanese test riders and stuff. So they could just show up and kind of blow everybody away, which was sort of their intention, surely. But once they got there, they didn't want to sort of look like the big, wealthy corporation that comes and races against Kingston University and just completely gives them no shot at all.
Well, I mean, this is the same company that flew McGinnis over to Motegi to do a test.
Yeah, they've been testing all over the place, which, yeah. you know, this is the most frustrating thing for me as a person, as a rider, is I never get to ride these motorcycles.
Until you get there.
You know, Steve Parrish on the live feed or something was saying, oh, you know, Miller's in with the team and I'm sure he's riding that thing back in the States all the time. And I'm like,
nope.
I've never ridden the bike once on a short circuit racetrack. All I've done the first 2 years, we ran out of lap, and then we did finish finally. We won the third year or whatever it was. Maybe it was the second year. And yep. then, you know, and it's been working okay. But the thing is, we don't get but one or two laps ever. You know, like yeah. that's it. So here's my last gripe, and I'm just going to just say it because it's keeping it real. The only real gripe I've got about this whole TT0 effort on my part is I've been asked to run Pirelli tires on the electric bike because they sponsor MotoSys.
Right.
So I'm riding on Dunlops all year and all my career and all week on my own bikes, my own super stock bikes and my super bikes and stuff like that, then I'm asked to jump on there with one lap and say, go down Brayhill and try to be the man on Pirellis all of a sudden. And even if the bike works exactly like a super bike or a super stock Japanese bike or whatever it is, an ice bike, the tires are completely different in every single way. The front feels different. The rear moves around different. And Rudder is on Pirellis all year.
Right.
And he goes to the TT and he runs Pirellis. And so he gets off his 17-inch stocker and then he jumps on the electric bike and he's going down Brayhill on 17-inch Pirellis. They're identical tires. I'm like Mr. Test Pilot trying to beat John McGinnis and Honda when he's on Dunlops, and he's on the same Dunlops he raced on the Superstock and the Superbike and all this other stuff. And here I am, Mr. like, okay, Miller, you know, you, I know you can do it, man, go. And it's like, what are you asking me to do here? Like, how could I win? Like, how am I possibly going to win and not scratch this $300,000 motorcycle?
I can see Mike. I can totally see Michael saying that. So let me ask you a question, because I know that Michael listens to the show and he'll probably listen to this one. Why don't – because I know he's doing his testing at PIRR, right? Portland International Raceway by the shop. Why don't you just say, hey, because there's a chance you may run this thing at Laguna during MotoGP weekend?
It was talked about, but I haven't we have not made any decisions on it. There has not been any decisions on it.
Okay.
The reason why I can't go to PIRR, let's say, prior to the TT is often the same reason each year, which is –
because you're there.
No.
What?
No, the bike's not done until the
they
have to shut the crate.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is totally understandable. So it's, you know, it's not from anybody not trying hard. And Derby was closest here to everybody. It was open like once or twice, but their electric bikes don't show up till nearly the end of the practice week anyway. And it's all about just basically getting the thing done in time to just literally throw the leg over and rip down Brayhill. So it's understandable, you know, like I get it. It's just would be more performant. We would be performing at a higher level guaranteed if, one, I could get some laps on it and feel what the Pirellis are supposed to feel like, because they steer so different. They feel heavy compared to the Dunlops. The Dunlops seem to be a bit harder and pointier and taller, and then they fall down on the side of the tire. Like when you get a brand new set of Dunlops on the street bike on the R6 back in California, every time I get a brand new set of fresh Dunlops on there, I literally fall over and I go, oh my God, I'm going to like, this is so weird. Like it just falls into the corner so abruptly. Whereas the Pirellis feel like you have to almost push through an uncomfortable amount of pressure on the bars and dig into the lean angle. And I'm like, dude, this is not right. I'm going to low side this motorcycle into a wall. And even if I don't get hurt, you see how these TT motorcycles crash at the TT.
Oh yeah.
They're always come back in little, they look like roadkill. Yeah. You know, the wheels are always shattered into little pieces. The tank's always gone. The front forks are always ripped off. Half the time the swing arms are ripped off. Like they always crash really ugly, even if the rider gets lucky and just skids to a stop. And I do not want to crash one of these motocross bikes, you know, especially with zero practice, because the first practice lap, the thing was unfortunately a little mechanical issue. No fault to anybody's. So it's sort of like, you know, go. And Rudder had three laps or four laps last year on that exact bike, and they went to Derby last year on that bike prior to the race. So I just feel like I was kind of I had it kind of going against me, and you know that's my list of lame excuses for not winning it.
But your shitty little world of racing.
Yeah, my shitty little world. And I tell you, I think that Mugen was up for it. I think they actually were up for winning this race had they had the even one more lap of practice. I believe they might have had the data to just eclipse what Rudder did. I don't know, because he already did a 102. He did a 97 the very first lap ever.
I know. I was quite impressed.
And then the second lap, which was in the race, he did 102 and some change. And that was with one lap of data. And the way they're doing it is they're giving McGinnis a full throttle body pull. Nice. And then they're giving him whatever – they're regulating the bike, not asking him to do it. So in other words, he gets to ride the thing as hard as it can be ridden. And then when he gets down to a certain position of battery left on his gauge, he gets to flip a switch and it gives him this huge rush of a second set of cells.
Yeah.
And because I overheard this with Mugen, I overheard it with John talking about it and stuff. They're doing it different than we are. We're doing it so that the rider are flying the gauges and we're using every single ounce of fuel getting across the line. Mugen is saying, ride the bike, and let's, over time, we're going to know what it takes to run out over the line.
And then he hit the electric nitrous button.
Yeah, well, if they had one more lap of data, they might have just said, well, yeah, no, easily. I mean, we've only used 40% this time. We're going to give you 57% this time. And then, you know, after the race, they're probably looking at the data going, God damn it. We could have easily given you, you know, 72% and you would have done 107 mile an hour average. You know, John would be riding the bike as hard as he could pull the string. And it's up to the engineers to give him just enough. Whereas, you know, we're basically using everything that we can and knowing, which I like our system better. But my only point is that Mugen just might have nipped us had they agreed to go and put McGinnis out for two laps that one practice day.
So the cool thing was y'all broke the time. So three riders, which was cool. Unfortunately, you didn't get the 10,000 pound check, which is probably kind of a drag.
I got half it.
Did you now?
Well, the team had asked Michael and Rudder and I if we wanted to split it, if one of us had won it and one of us didn't, in order to sort of kind of hedge our bets. And I didn't really think it was a great idea at first. And then I was kind of like, gosh, I don't know. It's like kissing your sister, you know. You win the thing and you got to give it to the competition in a way. And then after thinking about it a little bit longer and how unreliable – not how unreliable, but how – unique this race is, how you can run out of juice, how something can break, you know, they're prototypes and anything could happen. And so, you know, I asked Mike about it right before the first practice. I said, what do you think of this idea? You know, Michael's just was thinking maybe we could split our odds. And he's like, yeah, it's all right with me. If it's all right with you, I really couldn't be bothered. It's not, you know, da 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 da. And he was thinking because I'm starting second that I inherently had an advantage anyway, because all I'd have to do is catch him and then conserve. So we agreed and we shook hands on it right before the first practice. And he said it even after the race. He says, yeah, I've agreed to give half of this to Mark. So in a way, it's kind of cool because, you know, 5,000 pounds is 5,000 pounds. It's not a bad – it's kind of cool. You know, like we're working really hard on this stuff and we're definitely working as teammates and that kind of stuff too. So we get to share – but I did get a special trophy that says 100 mile an hour – club. Nice. You know, TT0 100 mile an hour club. So that's cool.
Well, now I know who's buying the beers at Lugina.
Yeah. If I go, I don't know if I'm going, to be honest, dude.
Yeah, we'll get you there. One way or another, we'll figure it out. Okay, so personal opinion, pretend nobody's listening, just between you and I. I know that you have a bit of an artistic aesthetic bent about you. I know you know what I'm going to ask.
No, I don't.
Okay.
You call me autistic?
No, I should though.
Yay!
Artistic, my friend. The new bodywork design, beautiful or ugly or something in between?
It's awesome.
Okay.
You see it in person. I don't know how it photographs, but it's sick, dude. It's sick. It's so cool.
Do you think it helped?
It could, yeah. It might. I mean, we did all right. We had 104 mile an hour is a big leap. I mean, that's from 99 to 104. That's 50 seconds improvement. That's a lot.
That is.
And I know they added a little bit of kilowatt hours. You know, they added – there was literally like a few centimeters of room in that chassis near – what, over the swing arm. And they added as much battery as they could, you know, in addition to last year. And it's only a little bit. It's just a couple percentage or something. But – it was enough with the aero package, and they lightened the bike slightly. I think it got a little bit lighter somehow.
Yeah, I think it was like 30 kilos lighter. And in fact, I think John's bike, the Mugen, was something like 40 kilos over you guys.
Yeah, well, that's what scared us because for it to be so heavy means they brought the muscle, and the muscle is really what you need around the TT because the rider can muscle the weight around, but you need that reserve, you need the power, you need to have the battery reserve. That's what's the main thing. I think the aero absolutely helped, and all of it was functional. It was all designed by, I was told, by a piece of software that simulates a wind tunnel. And it's all about the laminar flow and how it exits off of the bike and off the rider, and it uses, you know, the windscreen and the helmet. And the little winglets behind the legs was in order to capture the wind coming around, cool the batteries, and have it exhaust and then wrap around and continue off of our legs in a full tuck. And we're in a full tuck for that whole lap. So it is definitely, an improvement. Absolutely.
Cool.
I mean, you put a dustbin on there, you can get 3 or 6 miles an hour just from a dustbin on the same exact motorcycle, I'm told. That's massive. I mean, that's for 38 miles, you know?
Very true. Very true. So go ahead.
You don't like it, I take it.
I'm of a middle range. But you're right. It doesn't photograph very well. I'm sure if I had seen it in person, I would probably be in awe. And I absolutely respect the design decisions that Michael Sizz makes when it comes to building a race bike, because every time it's out, it's a continual improvement. So,
go on. Sorry.
I guess there's no but. It was cool looking. I would have liked to have seen it in person. Well, of course, I wanted to be there in person.
I will say this just for the sake of the pageantry or the fun of it. It was yet another year of absolute jaw drops when you see people walk up to it for the first time.
Yeah.
It had another wow factor. It had another impact of like, Jesus. Personally, I think the Mugen is ugly. I do not like it. It looks like a refrigerator. I don't care for it at all. But it's a nice piece of – obviously, it's an awesome machine. I mean, you can see it in the swing arm. You can see it in the frame and stuff. It's sick engineering. The way it looks doesn't give me a big heart on. But the way the Moto Sys bikes look, I think are sexy as hell. It's still like it's a whole new generation, you know?
The difference between the artist renderings of the – Mugen bike and the actual Mugen bike were not that close. The original, artist renderings were really cool, and I'm like, wow, that looks like just a regular racing motorcycle. And then what they brought was a little bit different.
But it's a TT, you know. This is like real endurance game, and I was intimidated by the fact that it was so bulbous.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what do they got in there? Like, what is their kilowatt hours? That's the big game is, you know, some guys are lying or some guys are pretending to have or claiming to have X number. You know, let's say if you had 20, you would be unbeatable. If you had 12, you're screwed. Somewhere in between there, you know, everybody's fluctuating. But if you had one over the next guy, that could be the difference between the winner, the lose, you know?
But that ended up being fun. You didn't look super happy on the podium.
You know, I tried not to look sad. You know, I didn't want to be like Rob Barber the second year when you're all grumpy. But honestly, I'm happy, dude. I'm standing on the podium at the Alaman TT with John McGinnis.
Yeah,
who's the man? You know, and Rudder. I mean, come on. It beats sitting in the stands. You know, I'd rather be doing this than watching it. It's fine. It's super cool. I'm lucky to be there. You know, I should have been out of the game a long time ago. No. the Aprilia might not be the absolute fastest bike if you're not Max Biaggi's team on World Superbike racetracks, but it's still a nice rig. It's a nice, beautiful motorcycle. It sounds cool. It's painted well now. The crew is awesome. You know, I like the owner. I like the press girl. I like her husband. I like all my mechanic friends. And
Zoe is a blast, isn't she?
She's awesome.
I knew her way before she was working for Splitlath.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she was feeding me inside info while you were there. So I was getting the scoop on your antics while you were at the
island. Yeah, she's hilarious. We were at one of the big, you know, award ceremony things, which is inside the Villa Marina, which is beautiful, old school Victorian, like big building with sound system and stuff. They have rock concerts in there. And we just got a goofy streak. You know, John bought the first round of drinks. John, the owner, we went to the bar and bought one round for the team. And he literally bought, I don't know if you saw the Facebook photos, but
I did.
We had about 60 pints of plastic, you know, cups on our table. Like everyone had like 3 or 4 of each flavor of what they wanted.
Yeah.
So by the time we got through, you know, the first round, which was of course 4 beers each, me and Zoe and John just started being goofballs, and we were like changing. It's like we were making a joke. I got to tell you this because it's just funny.
Go on.
Why do humans clap when they support something they like or they're proud of somebody on the stage? They clap. You know, like we're the only species that, you know, we make this noise with our hands, right? Which is dorky. You know, why – you see on Star Trek, you know, instead of clapping, they go, ugh, 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 ugh. You know, so why don't we just, like, do that like we have the mouth in our neck or, you know, like why don't we just slap our foreheads? Like, why do we, you know, so we started making up like new ways of clapping every time the sidecar guys went up there and got an award. We had to come up with like 37 different ways of celebrating the name when they call in, and John and so and so, na na. You know, we, instead of clapping and everyone else was clapping, we started going like, and doing these stupid dances. Like, we had to invent a new one for every single sidecar driver. Anyway, that was me, Zoe, and John, the owner, a little bit shit faced. Zoe's cool. John's cool. I like the team. I just wish we could. I think if we could start the TT right now with the K-Tech suspension and the Olin's and the 17-inch super stock bike, we would actually be kind of in it by the end of it. We just started so far behind with that Max and stuff. We never could get it to work. And by the time it was, we did a race on it. And then by the time we were like, this is not working, can we try something else? We're already ready for the senior, and the senior got rained out.
Yeah. And so that was kind of weird because, as far as I know, that is the first time that the senior was fully canceled. I know that they canceled it, or they actually suspended it once before, and they ran it, I think, at the Manx GP many, many years ago. Mm. But that was the first time that they actually just said, nope, we're not going to run it. They ran the lightweights instead, which are the 650 twins, and that's a lot of effort to come to naught at the, you know, nearly a week later.
Oh, I know. Well, some people were grumpy about it, but the way I looked at it was, don't be angry at them for choosing safety over commerce.
Right.
You know, at the end of the day, they didn't say, you know, we have North One Television, we have all these, you know, we have all these obligations to things. We don't think it's safe for the big, powerful superbikes. It's too wet. And it's, you know, we've tried our hardest. You know, we've kept you guys holding your dicks for 3 days and all day the last day till 9 at night and finally right. said, look, it's just not safe enough. I'm sorry. That took some balls and hats off, you know.
Well, on top of that, the other thing that they did up, which I thought was pretty cool, was they did offer, even though the spectators, because there are people that just come out for the senior, they offered the spectators a full refund.
The grandstand seats, yeah.
Yeah, even though they got to see the lightweight. So I thought that was pretty cool of the organizers.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've got no complaints.
Yeah. So all in all, how would you rate this TT for you? Pretty fun?
Well, it was fun. We're safe, which is good. This is number 7. So we've done it 7 times, fell off once, and you know, we're still walking and talking. So you got to look at that first. I missed my teammate. I thought it would have been an awesome 2 weeks with those guys around. We finished the 2 races. We didn't run out of gas. The bike looked amazing. We looked very professional, and the speed would have come, you know. I mean, 30th out of 70 starters is a good start for a young team with a very unique racetrack. Last year was a small disaster. This was the second go, and you know what? We improved on it massively. So there's just no way to look at it, but you know what? We did all right. It's just the way it is. It's a very difficult race, and to do 6 laps around there and then 4 more and a whole 2 weeks of practice or a week of practice and whatever, you know, we did all right. We did all right.
What was your trap speed on the Priller? I guess Sulby Straight is the quickest spot, right?
We were down, dude. We were down because we were overgeared. The only way we could keep it from wheeling is to gear it basically for as a 5-speed and have an extraordinarily tall first and second gear. Ah. And it's the only way we could kind of neuter the thing down low. Otherwise, it would just lose like, you know, 7 bike lengths on a Gixxer 1000 coming off the exact same corner with the same horsepower. Is I just be wheeling. I'm just trying to drag the rear brake and try to keep the throttle out of it, but you're just not moving forward. So Mark Buckley had actually figured that out at the Northwest, and we eventually went up in the truck and looked at his gearing and said, well, this is what he found to work best. Let's try it. And it did help the wheeling. Unfortunately, it took our 6th gear away. And so we were running around 5th gear, and I'd hit 6, and it would – bog. And so I don't know what the traps were. We did really good at the start finish line. We were at like 164 miles an hour at the start finish line, which was like 4th best out of all the superbikes once. You know, we were at a dry exit of the last corner, and the thing accelerates well when it doesn't wheelie. And so unfortunately, our terminal velocity on the Sulby Straight was down, but we could accelerate up to about 160 pretty well once it got sorted.
That gearing, however, did allow for some, or the initial gearing did allow for some great wheelie photos.
Oh yeah, early in the week we could not. Yeah, we had a lot, every single photo I'm wheeling.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of the same thing when you were running BSB last year. I mean, you just couldn't keep the front end down.
The only dangerous part of, besides it's annoying and stuff and it's really violent and crazy, is I literally almost crashed one time coming out of the windy corner, which is fast. I mean, it's like, I think it's third gear, but you're smoking through there. It's a nice, wide, smooth corner without, you know, when the wind is blowing, it depends which way it's blowing, but you got pretty good clip through there, and I was rolled on the throttle coming off the corner, and it wheelied off my knee and nearly low-sided me on the exit, and that scared the living shit out of me. So I came in and says, look, we have got to fix this. Now it's getting dangerous because I'm trying to push through it. I'm trying to go faster now, and every time I do it bites me.
Yeah.
So we had to do something drastic, and the only thing we could do without wheelie control was basically lengthen the thing and up the gearing. So we're going to have to figure that out if we ever do this again. We're going to have to really figure something out. Maybe – I don't know what to do. I don't know what else they could do. We already had all the weight on the front. We had, you know, the wheel really far back on the swing arm. There was one more change we could do with the swing arm pivot that we didn't get enough time to try with the K-Tech, but – It's a great little motorcycle. It's just not terribly easy to get around the TT course. We were the fastest of Aprilia. I think there was two others other than us, and we were the fastest out of the three stalkers. But you know, we should be.
Yeah. In an ironic twist, I suppose. Well, you, Mark Miller, were at the TT for practice week. I, Jim Race, and Jules Cisek were at Miller Motorsports Park for World Superbike, and I probably should have gone into Biaggi's garage and endured the wrath of them and taken some close-up photos of their chassis while it was naked and shipped them off to you.
Well, the Split Laugh team has hired a couple of the ex Aprilia factory team, so they've got some of the notes.
Good. Well, you know, I have to give the Split Laugh team credit because they've really stepped up their game this year. It seems like it to me.
For sure. I mean, they've spent a lot of money on some salaries, and it's just a matter of getting the bits, you know, it's getting the pieces, getting the notes, getting the experience. And they've got a couple of good riders in BSB, but they're still running around in the back, you know, 20 something place each weekend. And it's just so competitive. And the Hondas and the Suzukis and such have been around for so long with small changes, and they've got the notes for years and years. And I would love to know what it would be like, for instance, to get on a Clive Pageant Honda Superbike and just see what they're like, because those guys have been almost unchanged. They're still running White Power fork internals and pieces and bits and stuff from years ago. I don't even think they sell them anymore. They don't even make them anymore.
They don't.
They're still running the stuff that they know works. So the Aprilia team in BSB is basically, it's all, you know, different tires than I think World Superbike, and all the other teams like the Swan Yamahas of the world have got these incremental notes for years and years and years of making their bike slightly better on those exact racetracks with those bumps and that amount of grip and that exact kind of tire. You know, for Split Lap to come in and try to bite into that on a unique motorcycle with very little notes and, you know, one team in the whole world that can make a thing work, which is the factory team, you know, on smooth racetracks, on a certain kind of Pirelli tire, they're making them work. Well, you take them out of that environment and you start doing bumpy racetracks and all this other crazy stuff with different tires. It's not an easy job. And I, hats off to the Split Laugh guys, because I think they've been working their asses off and they're still in good spirits. They know that they're still learning and they're trying to put the money where, you know, as wisely as possible. And they don't have endless money. You know, they're budgeted as tightly or more tight than most. So they just make it look as good as they can with what they've got. So I like the guys, you know, I like, people ask me, well, you know, couldn't you get a more competitive bike? And it's like, yes, I probably could. I mean, I've had a couple offers this year for the TT, and I decided to stick with these guys because I wanted to see us kind of succeed a little bit over last year and, you know, build on what we had. So
there is something in you that I've noticed over the years, is that you appreciate being an underdog too.
Well, that way, when I ride like crap, I can blame it on other things. But no, yeah, you always have an excuse. No, but racers are full of excuses. Have you ever noticed that?
No, not at all. I mean, I never made an excuse for anything.
I mean, I wish the top guys like Casey Stoner, you know, the guy's the very best in the whole world. I just love how they never complain about anything.
Okay. Take two.
Veronique laughed at that one.
All right. That was perfect. I take it you're still riding on my MotoGP.com account. You watched the racing this morning.
Yeah, thanks for that. Oh, my God, I love it. I got my little iPad app going. I got my freaking, the 17-inch. I actually piped the stereos, the music, the voices, the commentary from the website onto the big stereo. So you don't have to strain to hear it. But, it's awesome, dude. MotoGP was so fun today.
Yeah. Actually, all three races were great. And Jules and I will be talking about that, or Jules and Martin, or me and Martin will be talking about it in this week's show. Martin got some killer interviews, which you'll either hear before Mark or after Mark. That was fun. It was I got up at 4 a.m. this morning, California time, and it was already like 75 degrees out. I'm like, oh, God. I'm looking at my – yeah. Oh, dude, it's hot here. It's way hot. All right, so I can't end it on this note because I want to hear, because there's always a story, Saturday night at Cutler's.
Well, it turned to Sunday night because we got rained out Saturday.
Right.
So nobody's going to go get shit-faced till what?
It wasn't Friday. It was Saturday.
Oh, instead of Friday, which is normally on senior day, it was Saturday night. So a funny thing has happened. Guess what it is?
What?
Colors.
Right.
Has been relegated to... No one's going anymore.
Really?
Yes.
Did it just get too boring?
Well, we went once midweek when we had our first day off the next day. It's typically during the practice week. It's a long week.
I saw the photos. You were clearly in training.
The next day we had off. So we just forced ourselves into Colors. We even got the manager outside and says, look, it's a ghost town. This place has – the word is out. Colors is done. No one's in there. I'm willing to bring in about 45 racer types from our last dinner area if you let us in for free, because they're still trying to do a $7 or $8 cover charge.
Do you remember last year I just walked by the guy? I thought he was full of shit. I thought he was just some dude that was out front.
So I was negotiating with this really – I don't want to talk badly about people. Yeah. This woman was just crazy looking. And not the nicest person in the world. I said, why are you trying to charge $8 cover charges when nobody's in there and nobody's going to be in there? And if if you'd like us all to come in tonight, give all the racers, anyone with a paddock, a pass, why don't you give us a free pass in there? And then I guarantee you we will buy some booze. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, we'll spend a fucking fortune inside there. But it's a little annoying to have to pay $8 just to walk in the place. It's annoying. And I think that's why people are angry at the place. Now everyone's over at the courthouse.
Where's the courthouse,
which is the newer place, the more hip kind of trendy place. It's large enough to absorb, a lot of people. And there's a place at the bottom as well with a really loud discotheque thing where you can't start standing room only. But you can kind of start upstairs to have a look at all the ladies, with the lights on. And then you can go downstairs and get loud. So it's kind of the new Colors, and everybody went there on the Saturday night. So we went big. Oh, my God. I got to tell a story because there's one story, and I'm going to tell it because I didn't put it on Facebook. It was too difficult to explain, but I will give you the scoop. This is an exclusive. True story. We got shit-faced, and it was a big group of us, and you keep running into family as you're out there and stuff. On the way out, somehow, some way, my mate, Gary Johnson, who, I took his slot for the Chicago thing, and then I had to brag about it in Macau, and he's come to LA and slept on the couch with, with his friend and stuff. We're friends. He was shitty. He was shit-faced beyond even us, and that was hard to do, but he was drunk. And it didn't seem safe. It seemed like he was alone. It didn't seem like for some reason he had lost his crew, something. And we didn't want to leave him there because he was in a state. He was just, you know, you need to kind of make sure he gets home.
He dribbled into a small puddle, is what you're saying.
Well, he was. You ever see that the latest Toy Story where the potato has to turn into a tortilla?
Yep.
He puts his nose and his ears in a tortilla, and he walks down the thing, and the bird comes and starts pecking at him. That's how, when you get that drunk, that's what you look like, right?
I'm picturing this.
so we basically kind of dragged him to our taxi and said, "Why don't you know just come home with us? We'll sleep on the couch. We have a couch. We have actually a bed that we had for Stefan Kuhn, and we had some other friends, and we had a blow up bed, so we had a couple people staying at the house. It's available. Come with us, and we'll make sure you get home safe and sound because we don't want to leave you like this." Gary Johnson comes back to our house, and we put him to bed. You know, tuck him in.
Yeah.
Good night, John Boy. Good night,
Mary Ellen.
Yeah. We go upstairs and crawl into bed naked like we would every day of the week. Vero and I. Dave's down in his own room, probably with – he also pulled a girl. So he had a girl.
Well, then.
Yeah. So we're in our bed. They're in their bed with their door shut. We're in our room with our door shut. We wake up the next morning, beautiful day, sun's out, the windows are kind of open, the windows, you know, sun's coming in. Oh, I got to take a piss, you know, I've got to really take a piss, and oh boy, does my head hurt. So I crawl out of bed butt naked, and I go to take a piss. I turn around as I'm leaving the room, I open the door, and I turn around and look back at Vero. Gary Johnson's under the covers with us. Naked. Not, he wasn't naked. He was in his underwear. But he was sleeping next to Vero, making a Vero sandwich. But he was all by himself being a good boy. He actually had, like, the covers between Vero and Gary. There was, like, a wall there a little bit. But he was sleeping in our bed.
No, wait a minute. You're upstairs.
We didn't even know it. We woke up and I go, "Baby, Gary's in bed with us." And she goes, you know, like, she's like, oh my God. And it was so fucking funny. And he rolls off, basically goes, "What? Oh, he didn't know where he was either.
How did he get up the stairs? That's what I want to know. There's no way.
On all fours. But dude, he was so funny. He was still drunk the next morning. But how he crawled into our covers without us feeling it was the funniest thing. We laughed about it all day. So to make a long story short, too late, of course, he's like, "What time is it? What time is it? I got to get my ferry. Where's my sock? I can't find my sock. I can't." And we finally, like, with one sock, and I think we found the sock eventually. He had, like, one shoe on with no sock. He goes bolting towards the sea, trying to catch his ferry because he was going to miss it. It was, like, leaving in 15 minutes. And it's about a 15-minute drive.
Yeah.
He made it. You know, if you ran flat out, you'd probably make it. But with his head spinning like that, he must not have felt too good when he got there.
Jesus Christ.
So our Saturday night story.
No surprise butt sex then with the sandwich?
I said, "Do you think he was petting you at night? Do you think he was spooning you?" She's like, "No, I don't think so. Because I woke up and there was, like, you know, da-da-da."
I thought it was you, honey.
You thought it was me, didn't you? Yeah, you little cheater. You little slut. You know. We had a good laugh about it, but oh, we didn't even feel him crawling to bed. We were so out of it ourselves. But we woke up and he was there. It's like,
that is too funny.
My God.
I believe that story will live on for many years.
Well, if you know Gary, it's probably even funnier. Yeah. Gary is the coolest, funniest, dorkiest, awesome guy, super funny. And, you know, I don't want to say the wrong thing. He's just he's a character, you know, like he's a child, like he's a likable child, very intelligent, super fast. He won a couple 600 races now.
Yes, stuff. He did. Yep.
You know, the dude's on fire. He's awesome. He's quick, but he's one of these eccentric racers. Like, you know, how can I compare him to?
Some guy named Mark Miller, maybe.
maybe I don't know. Anyways, that was super fun. We had fun that night. Nobody got arrested. I don't think anybody got in any fights. Although my T-shirt was really stretched out the next day. I went to put it on, you know, just to whatever. And I'm like, did I get in a fight, or was that from Gary trying to hold on to me when I was carrying him to this taxi? Or because you wake up sometimes and you don't really remember when you went to bed, but you have a big bruise on your knee,
kind of like Laguna last year.
Where are all these scratches on? Did I? Where is my? Why is my sweatshirt completely ripped? You don't remember? You know, like no. It was all right. It was all right. It wasn't a. We didn't get absolutely shit faced every night like we kind of in the past because we had such a long every. You know, we had so much good weather the first week that we had lots of practice the first week, and then we had the one day off, got shit faced in colors, and then had the big night Saturday night. So.
And Dave Hopkinson did not break a bone.
No, he did whack his face with a wrench again, or a foot peg or something. He had a what looked like a big pussy zit on his nose was actually from whacking his face on the bike, which was of course funny. But no, we set up all these booby traps for him to twist his ankle again and stuff. We were like all like scheming the whole team, and he never fell for it. It's really cool. He didn't get hurt this year.
How about Hinchy? I didn't hear a whole lot from him over the TT weekend.
Who?
David.
Biscuit?
David, yeah, Biscuit.
He was only over for a couple of days, and it was something to the effect. He brought a girl with him, his new girlfriend, and you know, he had been asked to kind of work on the bikes and stuff for another team, and so he didn't get a whole lot of time to show her around. So I didn't get to see him much either, unfortunately. We were all – it's such a big ask. Like everybody's trying to coordinate with everybody else, and – I had a lot of media functions for the government this year. You know, they're sort of becoming more organized that if you're an invited guest and you pull like an appearance fee, they'll put you to work now. And so they're getting to where they are writing out schedules for all the guys they pay to come over. You have to split all the like corporate functions. And I had to spend one of my days off in a van talking to one of the big, you know, and they don't even know about the bikes. All they know is they get free booze and their company is sponsoring one of the races, but they all live in Georgia, you know, like they're all from around the world in Texas and God knows where. And so they get this one night or this one couple days on the Isle of Man, which is where their home base is because of the financial tax breaks.
Right.
So now there's a lot more of these little PR things. So anyway, to try to coordinate with your good buddies is becoming more difficult. Especially when you've got teams and you got two teams, you got MotoSys and you got Splitlath and you got the award ceremonies, you know, and you got all these other little functions to do. I didn't get to hang out with Dave. I didn't get to hang out with my other friend Paul, which we tried really hard, or Suzanne Stick. I would have liked to hung out with Suzanne Stick a little bit more, but, you know, it's just really difficult to coordinate everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a decent American contingent, a bunch of people that I know over there, Dan Lowe, Carla Jennings. Well, I know you guys hung out, and you got to hang out with Brandon too. Which was cool. He's a cool cat. What's that?
Do you know Carla?
Yeah.
How do you know Carla?
Just from online. Mm. But we chat all the time. So
she seems to have some knowledge about bikes, eh?
Yeah, she's a sharp bike chick. Hi, Carla. Hi, Carla. All right, a couple more, and then I'll let you go because it's getting late-ish there. What is it? 3, 8, 11 o'clock at night. That's nothing for you. Having Derek Redmond as a team owner, that's kind of got to be cool from a, you know, a semi-historical Olympic perspective.
He's a cool guy. I like him. He did my visors for the first two races, and actually we couldn't start the bike – like one of the very first times, we were just kind of figuring it all out. And he pushed my ass down the pit lane. And, you know, he's got these huge legs, you know,
he's
a runner. And he's still active. You know, he's still pretty fit guy. But what a photo op for an ex-Olympian, you know, medalist to be pushing his own racing team bike. And the biggest joke was, I, you know, just don't push us so fast that we popped the 60K pit lane speed limit. You know, can you imagine if we got popped for a speed limit, you know, thing because he was pushing us too fast? But
that would be funny.
Yeah, good stuff.
Briefly, tell me about the whole HBO gig and what's the deal with that? When's it going to come out? What's the scoop?
Yeah, I don't know when it's going to come out, but hopefully we'll all hear. They came into my house to watch me kind of pack and do this little thing. We took the R6 out and got some knee down and got a bunch of GoPros on it. They just wanted to see, like, preparing for the TT. And then they sent out crew, the main crew. They sent, like, all four people. There's a producer, two camera operators, an assistant, and the talent, the MC guy, the guy who's answering the questions. But for Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel, they're doing
Really?
You know, between an 8 and 12 minute piece on the TT featuring me as, you know, one of the riders, the American, whatever. And we spent some time together. You know, I showed him around a bit, took him out to the Steve Hislop Memorial for as a photo op to do an interview with the backdrop of the prom in the distance and the memorial there. And he got to talk to some of the local fans who were out there to kind of touch the memorial and just say what's up to Hislop's thing. And they would loved it. I mean, the first time I ran into them in the Parc Fermé right before one of the practices, I mean, their eyes were huge. You know, they're just like, oh, yeah. This is cool. And they weren't all going to come until I talked to them in New York when I was in California. They were in New York. They called me about it, said they were interested in doing a coverage of this race. What do you think? And, you know, what did I think and what could I recommend? And this and da, da, da. And I told them about the TT and basically sold them on the TT as being worth going. And, dude, they after talking to me a couple of times, they all went. Like, they weren't all going to go. So, like, the entire staff went. And they were so stoked. They said it was better than I had even described it.
Well,
like,
it is.
They were just like, yeah. They're like, this is fucking cool. You know, this is so cool. They were stoked. And which makes me happy because they made the journey. You know, they've gone through the effort. And I just hope that it's a nice piece for them. I hope that they're happy with what they were able to get. And I sent some pictures of some older pictures of like standing on the on podiums with Nicky Hayden when he was really young and just like, you know, just different. They wanted some old backstory and I don't know what it's going to be, but it was neat. Then I spent an entire half a day with the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
The last day before we all left, they were out again, the same awesome gentleman, white haired dude from Cambridge. He's English, but does all these war correspondents for frickin', you know, the New York Times and all kinds of stuff. And here he is sort of at the TT covering it almost as if it's sort of, you know,
a battle
journalism. Yeah, it's neat. It's neat. So they took me out to where I'd crashed and the bike hit the wall and put a big hole in it and, you know, this big old wall. And it was neat. It's just really – I love talking to, like, intellectual, intelligent people, not you know, unlike yourself.
Yeah, I was going to say.
not unlike yourself. It's just nice, like these international travelers, you know, these down in the trenches kind of a real journalists that work for the New York Times. They're just so cool. You know, they're really intelligent. They're really just really rich personalities. And I've known him now for about 4 years. He keeps coming back now. And this is the longest time that we've spent together. And we just have a chat about life. It's just great. Just neat. Love people like that.
Neat. The Steve Hislop Memorial, that's the one that you and Vero and me and I think – Hopkinson went up to at night, and I shot a photo of the prom. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good picture.
Yeah, that's a very cool spot. All right, Vero, put your ugly boyfriend to bed.
She's gonna call in sick tomorrow, so we're gonna probably watch this movie and then go to bed.
All right. You two be good, and I will talk to you both soon.
Okay, my friend.
Thank you so much.
All right, brother.
Night-night.
Right. Night. Bye. All right. good stuff, interesting stuff, humorous stuff. Always fun to have Mark in the show. You guys definitely have to check out the video from HBO. We chatted a bit about that in that. And Jules, I think we should close this thing out. Again, thanks again to the donors from this last week and a half or so. If you'd like to do so, you can definitely do so through the Facebook fan page at motopod.com Facebook. You don't have to be a Facebook subscriber to do so, which is cool. So you can just go there and take a look and you can read what we talk about. You can also do it through motopodcast.com. And emails go through motopodcast.com. As Jules said earlier, it's the best way to get in touch with us. But you can do it through whatever means necessary, Twitter, carrier pigeon. We don't give a shit. In the meantime, Jules, we have rambled on as we do. And it usually happens when I haven't been on in a couple of weeks. So I've got all these ideas percolating in my head to listen to the show. And it's funny. I should just take notes when I do it. But then I go and listen, you know, try and refer to those a week later and go, what the fuck was I talking about? So it's just good to be back on. Good to talk to listeners. And I hope you guys enjoy the racing this weekend from Aragon and Assen. And we will, I guess, talk to them next week, won't we, Jules?
Before we go, predictions?
All right. Assen, weather's going to play a part. Maybe, maybe not. Sounds like Sunday's still going to be okay. Dry race. Shit. Yamaha. Am I cheating?
I like that. I like that. It could be Spies. It could be Spies.
Yamaha, Honda, Yamaha.
Okay. Cool.
Aragon. Italian bike.
A German bike.
Spanish rider. Two-wheeled vehicle.
There you go. Nice. Yeah, I think that Cheka is going to bounce back at Aragon.
All right. Friends and fans, thanks for listening, and we will talk to you guys again next week. Tune in or tune out.
All right. Ciao.
Later.
Calling for Jim Race. This is Agent Starling from the FBI. The Federal Bureau of Investigations has given us a memo that the IRS has not seen the taxes that you owe us. Please give me a call at area code 555-555-1212 and ask the Secretary for Inspector Gadget. And we're going to have to talk to you about putting you on some kind of a payment schedule because we've noticed that although your income has subsided for a couple months, your intake of beer has not gone down correspondingly. So we want to have a quick chat to ask you about that discrepancy. Give us a shout, 555-555-1212, Inspector Gadget, and have a wonderful day. You're getting audited, fucker.